The committee will come to order. There's not, we don't have a quorum yet, so we'll wait till later in the meeting to address the minutes. At this time, I want to just speak about what we are, the plan for the agenda is today. Today's agenda is to build on our reintroduction last week in this committee of discussion of Chapter 214, which oversees some of the process regarding licensing, both health and human services and health licensing, and also some other categories related to occupational licensing. We use that discussion to update ourselves on the purpose of that chapter, and particularly sections 0.001 and 0.002 regarding reports due from those requesting changes in their regulatory status. And as part of that discussion of registration, certification, licensing, where the state is on this, we have today followed up by requesting that Health and Human Services and the Health Department come and present for a few moments this morning on their role in occupational licensing as it relates to this committee. But more broadly, and I must note there are several committees of the legislature, both in the House and Senate, that deal with some aspect of occupational licensing. We are just one component of that, although we oversee quite a number of areas. But the Commerce Committees, Labor Committees, even Education Committee, all have addressed areas of occupational licensing and related to that. Thought it would be beneficial for us to understand a broader view of this. Many of us are new to this area in the last 2 years, and some will be new to it this year on the committee. There's a broad area of research and theory and evidence about occupational registration, certification, occupational licensing that exists. And while before this committee we often hear about it in terms of either health and safety issues and protection of consumers, or we hear about it in terms of definitions of scopes of practice for various groups, occupational groups, the issue is really much broader than that. It has to do with supply and demand conditions in the economy and the labor market. It has to do with the prices that we observe in the market for various kinds of services and functions. It has to do with the ease and mobility of labor across states in the United States and obtaining jobs in their chosen areas of work. And it also has to do with our higher education institutions in this state, and even probably even something vocationally in our high schools in terms of programs that they offer and types of, you know, whether they offer certification and coursework that leads to certification or licensing areas. So it has many effects on our economy and also on our institutional environment in the state, this whole area of occupational licensing. So particularly in an era in which we are concerned about the status of Minnesota's economy and the business climate generally and the work climate going forward, we wanted to just give ourselves an overview of this area so we have more depth of understanding as we move forward this session and into the future. So I thank you all for coming this morning. Briefly, okay, thank you. I've been told we do have a quorum. So we are going to address the minutes. Representative Norton, would you be willing to move the minutes of January 16th?
So moved.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. We've moved the minutes of January and passed the minutes of January 16th. Going forward, then, I just want to, we are going to begin today with a presentation from Professor Morris Kleiner. He's the AFL-CIO Chair of Labor Policy and a professor at the Humphrey Institute, University of Minnesota. He's also a faculty member in the University's Industrial Relations Center. His research interests include the influence of institutions in the labor market, the effect of labor-management relations, policies and organizations, and the role of unions in democratic societies. He's published extensively in these areas. He's been a co-author, co-editor of 6 books, including one specifically on licensing of occupations, and I believe he has another one on that topic underway. So we welcome him this morning, and as he's walking up, I said we are thinking in the range of 40 minutes or so for this presentation. We are then going to, if there are clarification questions during the presentation, we welcome those from members. Otherwise, we'll have some exchange after that. Then we will have the presenters from the Human Services and Health, and then after that, further discussion possibly with all three of them, going across the various presentations that we've had. So welcome, Professor Kleiner. Please introduce yourself into the mic once again for the record.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Representative Bunn and other members of the committee. Appreciate this opportunity. I just wanted to, I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, but this presentation reflects only my views, not necessarily those of the University of Minnesota. I'm also at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and the National Bureau of Economic Research, and this presentation only reflects my views and not those of the organizations where I'm employed. What I would like to do today is to give a brief overview of a book that I wrote that came out a couple of years ago, and it was called Licensing Occupations, Ensuring Quality or Restricting Competition. The book fortunately received a fair amount of attention, was reviewed favorably in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Scientific American, and recently received a selection as a noteworthy book for 2006 by Princeton University. The book covers a wide range of issues, which I hope will be relevant and useful to the committee. I'm going to be presenting some of the research from the book and updates, as Representative Bunn suggested. I'm currently working on another book, and I'll be giving some of the previews of the results of that book, which I'm hopeful will be of use to you in your deliberations on occupational regulation. The book, for those of you who are interested, covers many of the concerns of occupational regulation, both from a historical perspective and also looking at these issues from a demand and supply perspective, some of the economy-wide impacts of occupational licensing, comparing regulation in the U.S. to those in the European Union, and then discussions of how this particular form of regulation is developing, especially in the U.S., and mainly focusing on its economic impact. By way of introduction, what I would like to do is talk about the various forms of regulation, because I think some basic definitions are in order, and this is particularly important in terms of its economic effects and also potentially for its quality effects. The three major forms of regulation by government or licensing, which is the most restrictive form, and individuals who don't have a license and receive money for providing a service can be fined or imprisoned or both. Certification by the government generally means a right to a particular brand or title, so that no one else can use that title, but others can do the work. And finally, there's registration, which is the least restrictive form of regulation, which allows the government to keep a list of individuals who can provide a particular service. If there are a number of consumer complaints, individuals are deleted from that list maintained by the government of individuals who provide a particular service. So I thought, by way of introduction, I would provide some background and perhaps overview and familiarize individuals who work in government who may or may not be licensed. And here are a number of government workers, either current or former government workers, and some are or are not licensed. President Bush was not licensed, other than perhaps being a licensed pilot. Senator McCain was also not licensed. And Chair of the Federal Reserve Bank, Ben Bernanke, is also not licensed. He has a PhD. At the bottom, former President Clinton was a licensed attorney. President Obama is a licensed attorney, and Representative Pelosi is not licensed. And one can draw one's own conclusion as to whether licensing improves or hampers the ability of these individuals to perform their service as government workers. So those are just as an overview. Well, a question, should CEOs be licensed? At the top are two of the richest, in this case, men in America, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. Bill Gates didn't finish college, has done very well. Warren Buffett was initially licensed as a stockbroker, but has let his license lapse. At the bottom are two individuals who had a great deal of education. Kenneth Lay has a PhD in economics, and Jeff Skilling was at the top of his class at the Harvard MBA program. They were both top executives of Enron and have both ended up in prison as a result of their work with Enron. The question is, would licensing of CEOs result in any higher quality performance of these organizations? Would it stop unscrupulous or unethical behavior? One issue of licensing is the loss of innovation. And this is someone that I knew at the University of Minnesota who passed away during the past year, Leo Hurwitz, who won the Nobel Prize at the University of Minnesota. I believe he's the only person to have won the Nobel Prize at the University of Minnesota. And if Minnesota required licensing, he wouldn't have been hired because he doesn't have a PhD and was unlicensed. Yet he provided some brilliant insights that were accepted and recognized around the world. So those are some of the issues. Does licensing really help reduce unscrupulous behavior, and at what cost? Would it result in some loss of innovation and ability to choose, especially individuals who might provide some particularly innovative ideas? Well, does licensing eliminate charlatans, incompetence, or frauds? Certainly that's the objective. In this case, an article or a cartoon from The New Yorker shows an individual who built his own plane from a kit. Unfortunately, the plane comes apart with disastrous effects, I assume, on the pilot and other individuals around. So the idea of licensing is to make sure that this doesn't happen, that it's important to protect the health and safety of the public, both for individuals who might engage in behavior that would be disastrous to themselves and those around them. So that's an issue that that licensing and the whole issue, the whole question of licensing, really tends to frame. One question that comes up with respect to licensing is how big an issue is it? And what I want to do in this next section is to present the facts of licensing. There's an old TV show I'm old enough to remember, Dragnet, and the individual who always got his man, it was Joe Friday, and he always wanted to know what the facts were. Well, the next group of slides are some of the facts with respect to occupational licensing in the U.S., and then I will bring this back to Minnesota with some subsequent slides. Let me go back. Here are some trends in two labor market institutions. The green line reflects what's been going on with labor unions from the 1950s, where unions were about 30% of the U.S. workforce. The red line shows the growth of occupational licensing from the 1950s to now some 29% of the U.S. workforce requires a license. Remember, that's the most restrictive form, where you can't do work under penalty of a fine or imprisonment for providing that service for pay. And that has grown from around 4.5% in the 1950s to about 29%. Currently, there are over 800 occupations in the U.S. that are licensed in at least one state, according to the Council of State Governments. So the issue that you're addressing is an important one, it's a growing one, As part of your deliberations, it is one that is pervasive around the U.S. Here's some information that I recently gathered for the subsequent book that I'm working on. This is a survey that was done by both the Gallup organization, those of you who are familiar with political polling, and the Westat organization for Princeton University, where they did their standard polling results. This result was done in June through July of last year. It asked about the last job for those not currently employed. Random digit dialing, which is a standard methodology. One respondent randomly selected from the eligible household, and callbacks. You may remember those annoying calls you received, especially during political campaigns, up to 15 callbacks to try to elicit responses. And what they found was it was even more pervasive effect with respect to occupational licensing and regulation. The analysis showed that the people who were asked and responded, and this is very representative of the U.S. according to both the Gallup and Westat organizations, were that 35% of the respondents answered that they were either licensed or certified by a government agency. And this is either federal, state, or local. Approximately 6% stated that individuals who did not have a license could do the work, which, as you may remember, was the definition of certification rather than licensing, where licensing you cannot do the work. And another 3% stated that all who worked would eventually, must eventually be certified or licensed. And one can think of these individuals as CPAs who may have been hired, respiratory therapists who may have finished school but haven't completed their exams or their other continuing education programs, teachers who may be working for Teach for America who eventually do need to become licensed. So in terms of licensing and certification, rather than the 29% who are required to be licensed in the U.S., if you include all forms of government regulation, about 38% of the U.S. workforce are required to go through a government agency in some sense as part of their work. Well, who is licensed? Again, I'm trying to present some of the facts. By gender, there's not much difference. The blue line reflects individuals who are licensed. The red bar, I'm sorry, the blue bar reflects those who are licensed. And the individuals who are certified are the red bar, and you'll notice there's not much difference by gender in terms of individuals who are licensed or certified. By race, there also isn't a lot of difference in terms of individuals who are licensed. Really, the occupational composition would be very different, but in terms of individuals who require some sort of government license, there isn't a lot of difference across race groups. By sector, there are differences. Private companies tend to be much lower levels of regulation. The public sector tends to be require a great deal more licensing and somewhat more certification. So there are differences between public and private sectors with respect to occupational regulation. In terms of getting a license, what does it take to get a license? And this was also as part of these questions that were asked by the Gallup and Westat organizations, were that about 87% of individuals who are licensed are required to take an exam or test in order to become licensed, or if you're moving from one state to another, you also, in many cases, need to retake an exam. About 70% require some form of continuing education. About half require an internship in order to be licensed. About 40% have, a little over 40% require a college degree, and about 30% require as a minimum some form of high school education. Now, some of the issues that I'd like to talk about, since we now know the facts, is what are the theory, what's sort of the law and the economics of licensing. And there's sort of two views that I'd like to present to the committee. One is Robert Jackson, who's a former Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court and was the chief counsel for the U.S. at the Nuremberg trials following World War II, and in a major decision influencing occupational licensing, Associate Justice Jackson said the modern state owes an attempt to perform a duty to protect the public from those who seek for one purpose or another to obtain money, the basic definition of licensing. When one does so through the practice of a calling, the state may have an interest in shielding the public against the untrustworthy, the incompetent, or the irresponsible. The rationale, I think, is very well laid out by Associate Justice Jackson. On the other hand, Milton Friedman, who has attained a great deal of fame as an economist, won the Nobel Prize in the 1970s, noted that the overthrow of the medieval guild system was an indispensable early step in the rise of freedom in the Western world. It was a sign of the triumph of liberal ideas and widely recognized as such, that by the mid-19th century in Britain, the United States, and to a lesser extent on the continent of Europe, men could pursue whatever trade or occupation they wished without the buyer leave of any government or quasi-governmental authority. In more recent decades, he points out that there's been a retrogression, an increasing tendency for particular occupations to be restricted to individuals licensed to practice by the state. So very different perspectives on the role of occupational licensing. Well, why are states regulating more and more occupations? As I mentioned, this has been an area of significant growth. And what's the rationale, or can we think of a reason why occupations have been growing, where they were 4 or 5% in the 50s, and now are 30% or 40%, or approaching 40%, depending on which number you choose to use as regulation. So, is there what might be considered a perfect storm for occupational licensing? And what are the incentives for the practitioners of the occupation to obtain a license? Well, one wants to maintain standardization, that if you are working in an area where a lot of people do fairly similar types of work, then you form a group and then try to form some sort of standardization and enforce them. You then have an association. The association also has an incentive to seek regulation, both for fees that they can obtain through the testing of individuals who want to enter the occupation, and also the continuing education and internships which professional associations can benefit. Incentives for legislators are lobbying that these associations might provide to your offices. That is, individuals can tell you the benefits of licensing. They also can provide funding for campaigns, and they also can provide workers to assist in campaigns, so that there are incentives for legislators to promote regulation. Also, there are perhaps incentives for the governor's office. Certainly, fees are associated with becoming licensed, and often they're fairly high. The monitoring costs of occupations tend to be relatively low in comparison to the fees that are received by the practitioners. So given the incentive structure, there may be some might consider a perfect storm for the growth of occupational licensing over time.
Oh, Professor Klein, just note we have a question from Brookston's House.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Let me go back on the last slide. You state there's four incentives, and I'm kind of troubled by the last two. are there more incentives for the legislature to pass certain regulation other than campaign contribution?
Well, that would be one incentive. That is, I'm not presenting the full range, but certainly the occupations may come to an individual and provide contributions, provide workers to help you in a campaign. All those might be potential reasons to support a particular form of regulation. Theoretically, I'm not saying that this is theoretical.
Are there other incentives other than just the money and volunteer? As a legislator, I think we all know that more than just the health professions contribute. And so are there other incentives other than just what you say?
Oh, certainly the...
Go ahead.
Representative, there would be other, certainly doing, there would be doing the public's work, which would be the dominant incentive,
okay.
But perhaps what economists call at the margin, if you don't know which way, or it is not that important, at least for you individually, that at the margin, this type of rationale might provide reasons to support a particular regulation, especially if there's a large and powerful group that seeks changes or seeks to become regulated.
I think that the at-the-margin phrase here is helpful. I think that we feel that our primary duty is that we're public servants, and that our primary duty in this type of committee, particularly with health and human service areas, is that we are looking at public health and safety, and that the practice of the occupations of and their trades does not endanger public health and safety. That's our primary mission in this committee, if I see it.
Well, thank you, Representative Bunn. And I'm saying that this would be at the margin, certainly not the overall goal. And I'm impugning the motives, but saying that perhaps if it's very close, these factors may be important.
A little break for clarifying comments, too, on the last one. I assume you were, in terms of the governor's office or for the state as a whole, is that these organizations have boards. They collect fees under the Council of Health Plans and other vehicles that we have, health boards and other vehicles. It is in state statute that they do not collect fees greater than their needs in terms of cost. Surpluses do arise at times, and it certainly isn't the case, and I assume this is what you were alluding to, that in tough budgetary times, we have seen those special funds moved, transferred to the general fund for budgetary relief. So I'm assuming that's what you're alluding to, but if not, you should clarify the last comment.
That under those types of situations, that those fees potentially could be raised and used in that manner.
Okay.
So that is a potential source of funds.
Okay.
The legal basis, just to give a brief background, unlike many other forms of regulation, for example, the National Labor Relations Act, issues of unemployment insurance, which is done at the national level, licensing going back to the 19th century as a result of Supreme Court cases was really established at the state level, and that most licensing is done at the state level. In fact, two-thirds of the percentage of individuals who are licensed in the U.S. are licensed at the state level, and the state has been given control for the most part of regulation. Certainly there are federal occupations that are licensed at the federal level, and many occupations in a growing number that are regulated at the county and local level. Another major Supreme Court decision was Goldfarb versus Virginia, involving the legal profession, and the court ruled that the state bar's policy of an association's minimum fee, in this case Virginia had a minimum fee schedule, violated the Sherman Antitrust Act, the prohibition of combinations and restraint of trade. The legal profession, the courts ruled, was not a public service, but rather a market-driven service, and as a result, the Federal Trade Commission in the 1970s, 80s, and including most recently, and also a case that I was involved with, has become involved in examining occupations and are they serving as a prohibition or combination restraint of trade, and to what extent is that a problem and an issue involving the Sherman Antitrust Act. Now, the history of licensing, and this has been a recent article, states that the period of the 1880s to the 1930s, in fact, much of the legislation in Minnesota was passed during this period regulating doctors, dentists, lawyers, was a period when licensing laws were initially passed in response to the growth of knowledge within the professions, the dispersion, and the idea of having a common body of knowledge within the professions, the reduction in trade and transportation costs, urbanization. As a result, you didn't know necessarily who the practitioners were. In a more rural society, you knew your neighbors, you knew the practitioner's reputation mattered to a great deal, and during this period, licensing really started to grow. During the 1860s through the 1880s, there was very little regulation and state regulation of most of the professions. Now, here's the sort of the geography of licensing, and you'll notice Minnesota at the top is relatively low, and this is data that was gathered through the Department of Labor, through the Labor Market Information branch of the Department of Labor, which in this case breaks down licensing by low, medium, and high, and it has been fairly interesting for a researcher to be able to compare relatively low levels of regulation in Minnesota in comparison to Wisconsin, which is right next door. Other states such as California, Illinois, Michigan tend to fall into the high category, and this is licensing only by the states that the Department of Labor collects on a regular basis. In terms of what is the effect of licensing on quality, which is one of the main objectives of licensing, regulation can have some potentially restrictive effects through the pass rate, which over 90% of states require some sort of an exam, or 90% of the occupations who are examined require pass rates. Some sort of statutes impinging on or having a requirement on education or internships, and potential problems of reciprocity. So if a dentist comes here from North Carolina, do they have to retake the test? To what extent is that an important factor? And I'd like to sort of trace through some of the effects of occupational regulation and the effect on net quality to consumers, starting out with regulation, and these are all the various forms of regulation, in terms of what individuals have to do in order to become licensed. And as I've stated, licensing may have an effect on the flow of licensed practitioners. By imposing restrictions, it may reduce the number of individuals who are in a licensed occupation, either through exams, internships, or educational requirements. There are two potential effects. One is that the quality would go up by having individuals potentially go through additional years of schooling, studying for tests. Quality might go up, and individuals who are incompetent or unscrupulous might be kept out of the occupation. On the other hand, by restricting supply, the prices charged by individuals in these occupations might go up. So as a result, if prices go up because there are fewer individuals providing that service versus the issue of quality going up. So there's some tension involved with the effect on what quality is provided versus the prices that go up that might fence individuals out of the occupation. So the net effect is the key, What net effect is there in terms of quality to consumers? Well, one effect is the price effect would keep individuals from being able to purchase a particular service, and they might go to their brother-in-law or go without as a result of the higher price charged for a particular service. On the other hand, individuals who are covered by insurance, for example, or are relatively well off, would gain because the individuals in the occupation would be of a higher quality. They'd have higher levels of education. They will have studied more in a particular area. So the net effect is unclear in terms of what effect would there be as a result of both higher prices and net quality. And certainly there are other factors in terms of innovation, technology, that would influence the quality to consumers, which is certainly an issue for the public to be very concerned with. So this is sort of one way to perhaps think about how occupational regulation influences both individuals trying to get into the occupation might be fenced out, and also the effect that it might have in terms of influence in terms of net quality to consumers. Another sort of simple way to think about this is the famous bell-shaped curve. And this is a work done by Arlene Holen at the Center for Naval Analysis, where she looked at the number of applicants. And if you start out at point A, certain individuals are kept out. The quality shifts to the right. If you move it from A to B, additional individuals are kept out. But the overall quality or competence might increase. So the quality or competence of the individuals in a particular occupation who might want to go into this occupation would be increased. But that comes at the price of having fewer individuals in the occupation. So this is just another way of perhaps thinking about what role licensing regulation and the task that you are involved with, what are the potential effects. A couple of studies that have been done on different forms of regulation is licensing and quality. There was a study done by some students of mine at the Humphrey Institute who looked at complaints in certified Minnesota, where a number of occupations for physicians assistants, physical therapists, and respiratory therapists during this period were certified in Minnesota and licensed in Wisconsin. You may remember Wisconsin licenses a larger number of the licensees were these professions, and now Minnesota licenses these occupations, but at that time they didn't. But there was the ability to complain. Yes,
Professor McClainer, on this one, the difference between certification and license primarily being that certification gives you the protected label, but others can still practice. The question is, in terms of this comparison with Wisconsin, though, is whether or not anyone other than certified individuals were actually hired and practicing in the state, which could explain the results.
Right.
Do we have any knowledge of that?
No. We know is that in Minnesota, these individual others could provide the service, which is the definition of certification. We didn't know if others were providing that service. We know what we did was know what the statute that impacted both individuals in Wisconsin and Minnesota during that period.
Just a follow-up, and then others may have a question. We don't know then whether that employers themselves kept the standard by limiting themselves to only certified individuals and didn't take advantage of this option to hire non-certified. Lieutenant Hill?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding that last slide, the mentioned that there's no differences in the complaint, the changes in the complaint. Could that be because some of the folks who are practicing were licensed but under a different license or certify? I mean, the reason why we certify and license folks is to get competency. And so maybe they weren't licensed as a
peer assistant physician, but maybe they did have a certain level of licensure certification. Could that also be the case why the complaints are less?
There were really no differences in the complaints. There are many other reasons. What we did in this particular case was just look at the number of complaints to the boards under a regime of licensing versus a regime of certification.
So you didn't look at what level who was at license at what level. You didn't break that down on the practitioners, whether they're certified, licensed, or...
For Mr. Talon, Professor Kleiner, I assume he's asking whether equivalent categories were being compared across licensing and certification.
They were individuals who were in these occupations, and they were complaints to the certifying boards or the licensing boards. And there were no differences in the number of complaints relative either to each other or relative to a universally licensed occupation, in which case, for example, the complaints in Minnesota were higher for physicians who are licensed in both states, and we compared that to complaints that were for a universally licensed occupation, and there were no statistically significant differences in complaints. And this is just one piece of evidence. This is not a conclusive study, but but during this period, it was of some interest to note that a regime or a issue of the statutes covering these occupations during the period was one of certification in Minnesota and one of licensing for the same occupations over the same period in Wisconsin. Another piece of evidence does licensing enhance quality is evidence from malpractice insurance rates. And we looked at a number of occupations, marriage and family therapists, professional counselors, occupational therapists, and practical and vocational nurses. And some states, these occupations are licensed. In other states, they were not. And there were no differences that insurance companies charged for malpractice insurance in these states, suggesting that insurance companies didn't see that one type of regulation resulted in a larger number of incompetence or unscrupulous behavior as a result of licensing. Another area related to perhaps not this group, but a study that I participated in at the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis was looking at mortgage brokers, and here we also didn't find much of an effect of occupational licensing on being able to reduce problems in the home foreclosure area. We did find that that real licensing didn't have much of an effect at all. It did, in fact, in this case, was consistent with the theory that I laid out, that licensing did result in fewer brokers, fewer loans issued, somewhat higher foreclosure rates because of the monitoring, and more higher priced loans because there were fewer individuals providing the service. And at least in this study, looking at it, certainly not a health area, but an area that has gathered a lot of attention, that licensing didn't serve as an anti-consumer entry barrier, or consistent with licensing as an anti-consumer entry barrier, but not supportive of the human capital, the idea that licensing results in greater skill and abilities of the individuals in this particular occupation. Now, what effect does licensing have on prices? Certainly that was part of the theory we suggested, that the impact of licensing on prices, and this is information from a broad range of studies, some from the Federal Trade Commission, some from the academic literature, suggested that licensing increases prices in terms of commercial practice, depending on the commercial practice and location. But licensing laws fall disproportionately on low-income individuals who often have to do without, and as potential entrants into an occupation, individuals who are kept out of an occupation as a consequence of licensing, with no clear, necessarily clear effect on overall quality. Here might be an example to sort of lighten the air as opposed to looking at the data. This was from the Ann Arbor News, and it was tried, "Don't try this at home, man does his own root canals." And here's David Krudoff, is no dentist. He's a hired hand on a fruit farm outside of Lakeville, about an hour northwest of Grand Rapids. But that didn't stop him from performing two root canals on himself and fashioning an entire set of replacement teeth. The reason for that in this case was he couldn't afford to go to the dentist and didn't have dental insurance. Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, Professor. It's early and the synapses are firing a little slowly, so I have a question about the slides, a page back or so where you're talking about complaints received based on the level of licensure, certification, regulation, et cetera.
Right.
And so I'm wondering in the U.S. if you've been able to do any sort of apples-to-apples comparison, licensed, regulated, whatever form of regulation, versus not regulated, and number of complaints being issued. And in the case of not regulated, where would the complaints go?
In terms of certification, in this case there was a board that individuals could file complaints in the Wisconsin-Minnesota case. There has not been that level of comparison. However, insurance companies don't charge, for the most part, and this is the case for dental hygienists and many other areas that this committee is responsible for, that insurance companies do not charge differential rates, as far as we've been able to assess, charge differential rates for in those states where individuals are unregulated versus states where they are regulated. And if there was a problem, for example, there were a lot more lawsuits because of incompetent practice, then this would lead, I would assume, attorneys would file, would go to court, and there would be large jury awards in those cases. Again, this is not conclusive, but it is circumstantial, that insurance companies don't see licensing as resulting in fewer malpractice lawsuits, and as a result, they don't charge a differential rate to these practitioners in one state or another based on whether they're licensed.
Just one comment on that, and I also want to ask Professor Schneider, I want to say probably only have about 7 more minutes for your portion of it. But one comment is on that is that maybe those in the agencies that are going to be presenting today could comment on unregulated areas versus regulated, whether there are paths for complaint. I mean, we have things like massage therapists that are only regulated by application license in, like, you know, geographic places. I assume there might be a mechanism still, though, for complaints against, you know, unregulated groups like that. So maybe you can make some comments on that, whether there's a ombudsman or state agencies receive complaints, even if it's not a certified or licensed area. Go ahead, sir.
Here's another case study and some of the issues that come up in terms of licensing church and state. Another case, in this case, involving the Amish community in Pennsylvania, where one of its members was fined for practicing dentistry without a license. There was at least among the individuals who provided service to, there were no obvious complaints, but there were, in this case, the case was filed by the dental board in the state of Pennsylvania. Well, what are some of the bottom line effects? And this is, I think, I want to conclude with this. What are some of the potential losses? Overall, there's sort of two effects. One is a reallocation effect from consumers to individuals in the licensed occupations. That is, individuals to the extent that they can't fence out individuals. There's also a deadweight loss. Individuals can't, to the extent they're working in an occupation that is their second best choice. And there is lost output, and the estimates in the early 2000s was between $34 and $41 billion. The estimates done in Minnesota, this was a report for the Office of Legislative Auditor, at least that was where it was presented, was about $1.1 billion in 2003. So those are some of the overall losses, and that doesn't include what might be considered, to some extent, maybe a Robin Hood effect. The individuals who are licensed are able to get additional earnings or wages from individuals who are consumers. So in summary, as a result of new estimates from Gallup and Princeton, approximately 29% of the workforce is licensed, and that in comparison to other institutions in the labor market like unions, about as twice as large. The benefits of licensing are increased standardization of services and a reduction in what might be perceived as loss aversion by consumers. That is, there's some view that licensing provides a quality. So if you go to a licensed practitioner, you feel much better about going to someone who has that government stamp of approval. Some evidence that consumers covered by insurance or higher income categories gain from stricter licensing, that is, individuals who they're likely to go to are of higher quality. They've had more education, they've passed exams, they've gone through internships, they go through continuing education. But that may be balanced by individuals at the lower part of the income distribution. The overall effects are hard to measure. Let me go back. What are the price and wage effects? Licensing drives up prices. And the overall wage effect relative to unlicensed occupations is about 15%. And that is almost the same effect as the impact of unions on wages. So licensing is able to enhance the earnings of individuals who are members of a licensed group. In the effect of licensing on employment growth, within an occupation, within one, as I mentioned, there are a lot of occupations that are licensed in some states and not in others. The employment growth rate is about 20% higher in states that do not require licensing relative to those who do, but the impacts differ widely based on methods and occupations. So that's sort of the average effect. There is lots of variation. As I noted earlier, states regulate at different levels. Some states like California, Connecticut, license a much higher percentage of the workforce than states like Kansas or Minnesota. And case studies show that political spending by an occupational association is an important factor for those who get regulated. So there is some evidence to suggest that lobbying and fundraising by the associations do seem to have an effect on the occupation becoming regulated. The estimated losses in $2,000 are the redistribution effect and then what economists call the lost output effect. Although the numbers are large, perhaps by the recent bailouts, they're relatively tiny. This is less than 0.1% of total consumption expenditures in the U.S., although for most of us they would seem to be fairly large. If you compare the U.S. to the European Union, the European Union does a very different way of licensing. There are no exams, however, they regulate prices charged. And as a result, the wage effects for licensing are smaller in Europe than they are in the U.S., which is many times larger than the wage impacts of licensing for the individuals in the occupations. So I thought I would conclude with a licensing fable to end on a lighter note. And this is not long ago. Let me just go that the governor of a Midwestern state was approached by a representative of a trade anxious to enlist the governor's support in securing passage of legislation to license their occupation. Governor, they said, passage of this licensing act will ensure that only qualified people will practice the occupation. It will eliminate charlatans, incompetence, or frauds, and it will thereby protect the safety of the people of the state. The governor, from long experience, was somewhat skeptical. My distinguished guest, he asked, are you concerned with advancing the health, safety, and welfare of the people under the police powers of the state, or are you primarily interested in creating a monopoly situation and eliminate competition and raise prices? The spokesman for the occupation smiled and said, "Governor, we're interested in a little of each." And this is adapted from the time when licensing was just starting to take off in the 1950s. So I thought I would conclude with a licensing fable. Any questions?
Thank you, Professor Kleiner. Professor Ruth?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Professor. I want to go back to something that Representative Murphy touched on, and then kind of a follow-up to that. You mentioned that states that had professions or professionals working that were licensed versus unlicensed or credentialed didn't necessarily get charged higher rates of malpractice, for example. They didn't just make the differentiation. But do insurance companies reimburse at a higher rate for individuals who are licensed and credentialed? I know that it does drive up the wages, but...
Right. We didn't look. We only looked at what the insurance companies were charging across a wide variety of occupations. And one occupation that I'm working with fairly recently, just in terms of getting data, are dental hygienists, and their scope of practice doesn't seem to have an effect on the insurance rates charged for malpractice.
So, Rube, were you referring to what the insurers paid for the medical service?
Yes.
Okay, so it was a different question.
Yes.
It was
right.
About,
we didn't look at what the prices were. That licensing does tend to drive up prices. In a study that I did with a colleague at the University of Minnesota, that tougher regulations did result in higher prices. The case we looked at was dentistry.
Mm-hmm. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask a question about a topic you haven't touched on in your presentation, but knowing your depth of knowledge, maybe you have an opinion on this you could share, and that's with grandfathering. I have been kind of wrestling with the idea of grandfathering everyone in that's currently practicing something and saying, all well and good, versus grandfathering someone in with the expectation that they will meet the standards or requirements within a certain period of time. But in looking at the research that you've presented, it doesn't look like it will make a difference, or if you expect them to meet the credentials within a given length of time, if they're certified and they already aren't getting complaints are being filed, then what difference will it make if you ask them to have their level of training be the same as the people that are licensed? So I guess, do you understand what I'm getting at? I'm struggling with this, and I'm hoping you have some research or opinion you could share.
Well, Representative Norton, very, very good question, and unfortunately there hasn't been any empirical work done in this area. So really any opinion I would offer would be pure speculation that individuals who've been doing the particular work and there haven't been lots of complaints probably would do a pretty good job. But again, there's no evidence to suggest that they would or would not do any better than the new entrants.
Thank you.
Professor Kleiner, I think we're going to move on, but ask you to stay near my so towards the end, if we can, if there are questions that might come up after our next presentations that might involve you as well in answering. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank Representative Bunn and the members of the committee for the opportunity to present some of this work on licensing. So thank you.
And next we have Tom Eidelmeyer from the Director of Health Occupations Program at the Department of Health. And while you're walking up, Mr. Heidelmeyer, as well, first of all, correct me on my pronunciation again if I botched it once again. And secondly, we also just recently, you issued the report on health workforce shortages issues in Minnesota, a section of which addresses licensing issues. I'm not clear that you could get into all this today, but if you have any comments on that report and the section on licensing in relation to anything that Professor Kleiner has said today, you're welcome to mention those as well, in addition to prepared specifically for this.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tom Hindelmeyer, Director of the Health Occupations Program with the Minnesota Department of Health, and excuse me, I'm going to talk a little bit about myself first. I may also sound like I'm giving you a lot of personal history, and it is a fact that I've been doing this for about 20 years and have been involved in a lot of the occupations that I'm going to describe for you as the health department having been involved with over the last two decades. In my current position, I'm responsible for credentialing audiologists, hearing instrument dispensers, speech language pathologists, they're all in the speech hearing industry, occupational therapists, and there are two levels of practitioners there, therapists and assistants. We also are responsible for the Office of Complementary and Alternative Healthcare Practice, and this is a model that responds a little bit to some of the information that Professor Kleiner talked about. It's a form of regulation that doesn't involve any credentialing. It's strictly utilizing the police power of the state, but we're not issuing a registration, a license, or a credential in terms of responding to consumer complaints about practitioners who are not currently regulated in the state of Minnesota. We had a similar activity up until 2005 for mental health practitioners, and in 2005 that was transferred to the Board of Social Work. We have in the past also licensed alcohol and drug counselors. That licensing law was passed in 93 with responsibility given to the Department of Human Services. In 94 it was transferred to the Health Department. Mr. Kerber from the Department of Human Services can share a little light on why that occurred. But we had some experience regulating mental health practitioners from the Office of Mental Health Practice, and we had experience regulating personnel as a program as opposed to licensing programs and facilities. However, it took 4 years before we issued our first license for alcohol and drug counselors. There was a lot of legislation that really remained to be done with regard to that group. And it took 4 years to do rules, rulemaking, to finish fleshing out all the standards and qualifications and processes for licensing alcohol and drug counselors. In 2005, the legislature decided to move licensing responsibility from the health department to the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, and at the same time they decided to license professional counselors who had been subject to regulation under the Office of Mental Health Practice. I currently am involved with two other groups. One is doulas, which we have a registry. We don't provide a credential, but to be on the registry, it's required that you have a certification from one of a variety of national organizations. So in a way, it's not really regulating, but it is providing the same kind of benefit to the public that a traditional regulatory scheme would provide, in terms of folks can go to the website, they can see who has the national certification and make a decision on that basis. I'm also involved with setting up a regulatory scheme for healthcare interpreters, spoken language healthcare interpreters. We at this time are beginning to populate a roster, and have been asked by the legislature to work with community groups to develop a plan for a registry and ultimately a certification system for spoken language healthcare interpreters. So that's the range of my current responsibilities, and now to direct your attention to a little bit of the history of the health department's involvement in occupational regulation and licensing. One of the handouts that I updated this morning is titled Minnesota Department of Health Chapter 214.13 Sunrise Reviews of Health-Related Occupations from the period 1985 to 1990. I was involved in many of these reviews. They ended in 1990 when the legislature chose not to fund the activity anymore. It's general funded. And it was sometime after that then that the legislature created the Council of Health Boards and set up the process, if you will, for referring occupational groups for reviews by the Council of Health Boards, as you heard about last week. With regards to this list, I think it's really interesting to look at Professor Kleiner's picture. It was on page 7 of his handout, but it was the geography of licensing. And I can tell you that a number of the states that are not colored in, they're white, Nebraska, Washington, Colorado, Arizona, are what we call, or used to call, sunrise states. The sunrise statute in 214.13 was essentially an attempt to do an evaluation of whether or not to impose regulation before it actually went ahead, as opposed to sunset reviews, which take a look at whether or not laws are effective and should be possibly repealed or continued. So this sunrise activity, at least in looking at the geography of licensing, appears to have some correlation with states that have sunrise laws and that engage in a process of deliberation in comparison to a set of standards or policies as to whether or not an occupation should be regulated. And you heard about that last week in the presentation that was made by Ms. Avies. So the table that I've given you essentially lists all the occupations that were reviewed in an approximately 5 to 6 year period. You'll note that some of them are not regulated currently, particularly in the optical area or optical industry. I think that another comment I make in reference to Professor Kleiner's remarks, you should note that almost all initiatives for occupational regulation do come from professional associations or the schools that do or would train individuals who would be regulated. Very, very rarely, and I am pretty certainly say, in my experience, I have not seen a consumer group come forward and ask that an occupation be regulated. But one thing that's really changed in my tenure in this area is that though originally and technically occupational regulation was an exercise of the police power to protect the public, today, occupational regulation seems to be more a quality assurance function and for the healthcare delivery system. Mm-hmm. And evidence of this is that occupational groups in the 80s and early 90s could count on hospitals opposing any initiative to regulate in the healthcare area. And now, the industry is essentially a supporter of healthcare regulation. And I think the reasons have to do with the efficiency of the healthcare system. Healthcare employers and providers have an easier time identifying individuals who are qualified if the state has already gone through a process of credentialing, at least to some minimum level. And I don't mean to suggest that providers and healthcare organizations don't do their own credentialing. They do. But it's on top of the credentialing that the state already does. Mm-hmm. And so we have in place a pretty comprehensive system in Minnesota for minimal credentialing of a lot of our healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's evident from Professor Kleiner's geographical map is Minnesota doesn't regulate everybody. And that we have, I think, been very deliberative and made some tough choices in terms of deciding who is to be regulated and who isn't. And the table that I've given you is clear evidence that not everybody that sought regulation in Minnesota has obtained it. The other thing that's clear from the table is that's interesting to me is that it takes a long time for an occupation to decide it wants to be regulated and then ultimately get regulated. And you can witness naturopathic physicians who first came to the health department in the late 1980s, was reviewed in 1990, and is scheduled to be registered in 2009.
Mr. Heidelmeyer.
Yes.
What happened if on the end of 1990, when you said the stop in funding took the teeth out of 214.13,
mm-hmm.
until 2001, when I think we approximately when we added 214.002, so the chair of a committee could send over a review to the Health Council's health board. In that 10-year period, what was going on in terms of was anyone doing analysis of, you know, the merits are of or recommending outside the legislature itself of occupational regulation requests?
Best of my memory, there was a very short list of occupations to be reviewed. Okay. In other words, we kind of ran out of occupations. I think massage therapists were on the list, but they were not ever reviewed. In 1995, the department was asked by the Board of Medical Practice to review traditional midwives, and we did do an occupational review for them of that group at their cost. There were initiatives during that time period, and Representative McCollum, when she was a member of this body, actually authored a massage licensing bill. But massage practitioners have made many attempts to be regulated and have never had legislation passed.
Mm-hmm. We will have to move on and just note to our last presenter, but when you said the 1995 midwives, it was at their cost. So which group in your agency did the review?
I was involved in that review. Our program, but the cost was paid for by the Board of Medical Practice.
Not by the legislature and not by the practice. Okay,
itself.
I thought you said the practice. I thought the Board of Medical Board. Okay, thank you. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two quick questions. One is, I'm hearing a historic discussion of review by the department, and now we have the Council of Health Boards, which testified that it does review things, but it doesn't make a recommendation.
Correct.
And so I'm wondering, when you reviewed things historically prior to the Council of Health Boards, was there ever a recommendation forwarded at that point? I'm a little frustrated with the lack of recommendation, I guess, as someone who isn't part of all these professions. And so that's my first question.
Madam Chair and Representative Norton, the other thing that's interesting and can be gleaned from the list of occupations reviewed is what is listed as the Commissioner's recommendation and then what is the current regulatory status.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great frustrations of the review process was that the Commissioner would make a recommendation and the occupation or the professional association would go to the legislature anyway and ask for what it wanted if it didn't get what it wanted from a Commissioner's recommendation. And so you see differences there in terms of what was recommended by the Commissioner and then what the outcome was in terms of the legislative decision to regulate or not regulate.
Okay, so reviews were, I didn't have the copy in front of me, I'm sorry, missing from my packet. So I appreciate that. My second question had to do with the sunrise and sunset states that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a history of actually reviewing and dismissing something once it's already been registered, certified, or once it's in, it's in?
There has only been one occupation in the state of Minnesota that was licensed that no longer is licensed. In other words, licensing was repealed. And that was for hospital administrators. They were licensed and they no longer are.
This has raised a whole lot of questions for me, actually, which we'll have to follow up further. But because of we have a last speaker, I would ask if we could move on at this time. Thank you so much. It's been very helpful, particularly seeing this table and also hearing about the pre-1990 practices. So I certainly, and I'm sure other members of the committee will have additional questions at some other time or want to meet with you to discuss some of this further. But thank you very much for coming in today and whetting our appetite for more information. State your name for the record.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Director of the Licensing Division of the Department of Human Services.
And Mr. Kerber, let me just say, since I don't think I would want to be fair to you, I'd like to go to five after, and I'll be tighter in my future control of meetings. But I don't think we all have many, many full schedules this morning, so maybe we can afford the 5 minutes. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, there shouldn't be a problem. I think the first thing I should explain is that we don't do licensing of occupations, really. We license what we refer to as facilities.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we are more like that area of the health department that licenses hospitals, nursing homes, mm-hmm. home care agencies,
mm-hmm.
and the like. And so there are no individual licenses that we issue. And so I think I have a handout here that just sort of walks through some general information about our licensing activities. We have like 25,000 licenses that we issue, and our licensure is in the areas of we license child care services and foster care services for adults and children,
mm-hmm.
Adult daycare services, whether it's a facility or it's in a home, mental health treatment programs, chemical dependency treatment programs, and any of the services for people with developmental disabilities throughout mm-hmm. the states of a variety of types. And we do that according to two models. Some licensing functions are delegated to counties, and those are more associated with adult foster care and child foster care and family child care, those services that more often than not occur in somebody's home. And the other services are licensed, are monitored directly by our staff. But we issue all the licenses, and the complaint investigations are kind of divided up a little differently, but we take all the licensing actions. We issue the sanctions when necessary. And I have some of those numbers on here. Our staff do the monitoring of roughly 4,000 programs. Counties do the monitoring for the other 21,000. I have some information in here about our investigations. And then the other function we perform are background studies on the people who work in those programs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do about 1,000 background studies a day, and we do them for programs that are licensed by the Department of Human Services and programs that are licensed by the Department of Health, the Department of Corrections, unlicensed PCA agencies, and there's a list on here. We also do some background studies for the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy on chemical dependency counselors. We have an agreement with them that's sort of set out in statute where we obtain the criminal history information and treatment background on those applicants for licensure and then give it to the board.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some general background. I think there's one other point that I might add about the function of our licensure. I think historically, the legislature has decided that there are some kinds of services, the ones that we license, that should not be left to a buyer beware arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has been a requirement put in that in order to provide those services, you must be licensed, and so we have that duty. We see our complaint investigation function is pretty important. Because we not only enforce minimum standards for the care that's provided, but we also are able to order corrective action. And so if there's either a complaint or we discover that somebody's not meeting the minimum requirements, we order their improved performance. And on an increasing basis, I think we are performing a function to assure that public dollars are spent appropriately. All the programs that we license in one way or another get some kind of public funding. And so there is an accountability function to our oversight that I didn't hear mentioned earlier. So that said, I can try and answer any questions.
Okay. Let's move down.
Thank you. Mr. Kerber, does your department have the ability to monitor or sanction someone who's not licensed and it's not in the purview of of statute?
Madam Chair and Representative Tao, there is a pretty clear delineation in our law. It's never as clear as we want it to be of who needs to be licensed and who doesn't need to be licensed. But the law also sets out that to provide one of those services that requires licensure without a license is a misdemeanor. And so it can be prosecuted either at the local level or in some cases the Attorney General's office can be, we can request the Attorney General's office to become involved. And so, you know, I'm not really aware of any cases where anybody has been prosecuted. Generally, if we're aware of somebody providing a service that requires licensure and they don't have it, simply our educating them about that requirement is enough to either they apply for licensure or they stop providing the service.
So, Mr. Kerber, so in some ways, whether we license a certain group of individual or not, we do have some criteria to protect the public.
Madam Chair and Representative Tao, in that regard, yeah, in these services that we are involved in, you know, it's been the policy of Minnesota that if you hold yourself out as providing that service to citizens of Minnesota, it has to meet the minimum standards, and that's the role of our licensing function to hopefully assure that some minimum standards are met. And if you're not licensed, there's nobody assuring that minimum standard.
Mr. Kerber, I have some questions about the interface between your facility licensing or program licensing and individual occupational license, in that I would assume that when you hear of a violation at a facility and you go to investigate, you may determine, one, that there may be people who are not licensed or certified who are supposed to be. And if so, my question is, do you report that to those respective boards or the agency that's appropriate? And secondly, you may find that it's a certified, that the violation has to do with a certified or licensed individual within that facility who has potentially violated points. Do you report that? Is there a process for you reporting that as the facility inspector to the individual licensing or certification agency?
Madam Chair, yes, there is. In our licensing standards, in some types of services, there is a requirement that certain people hold a professional license, and in others, it's not. And, you know, that might be one way that they can meet the criteria to do that service in the license program, say, like child care centers. If you're a licensed teacher, that you meet the qualifications to be called a teacher in that setting. But there are 9 other ways that you can demonstrate some qualifications to do that job. But as it relates to that, there's kind of 2 things, right? Both our Data Practices Act and our Licensing Act in 214 dovetail in that way, so that if we're doing an investigation and we have any reason to believe that the professional licensure standards may be an issue for somebody, then it's our, I mean, we not only have the authority, but we have some responsibility to report that then to the licensing board. Similarly, if we're doing a maltreatment investigation, investigating abuse and neglect, and it's in a facility, and we determined that a licensed person was responsible for the maltreatment, the legislature a number of years ago made the change that we don't have the authority under a background study law now to sanction somebody who has a professional license. Instead, we provide that information to the professional licensing board, and then whatever standards are in place by the board, they take that action. And so we are very much in touch with them.
Okay, other questions from members? So at this time, any final questions that relate to any of the 3 speakers that you've left unanswered you'd like to at least put out there for them to hear and make a quick response or follow-up? Professor Plumtown.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I was looking forward to this hearing. Coming in, I was hoping the committee would get some direction on, we'll pick up some directions anyway on where we should go from here. But I didn't pick anything up. I think we're back where we started, and this morning we heard a lot of, I think, case studies and
licensing 101, so appreciate the hearing.
Well, in conclusion, I want to say a couple things. First of all, I want to thank Representative Tao for allowing me to organize this hearing. It was very gracious of him to do that when I brought up the idea, and appreciate that allowing us this time this morning to have this hearing. Secondly, in terms of where this leads in terms of thinking about the future, for me at least, particularly with respect to Mr. Heidemeyer's presentation, I'm interested in exploring a whole re-examination of all of 214, frankly, this in the next 2 years, and certainly key components of it. I've been meeting with, talking to fellow legislators about some of that, been meeting with legal staff about and research staff about that, maybe speaking to the AG's office about kind of how they might weigh in on approaches to re-examining 214. I think that there are some many different issues involved in it, and also if we are to have a sunrise type legislation, which we still do in 214.02, whether or not it's enforced has teeth, whether or not the previous type we had prior to 1999 was a better model or a worse model, who should do these evaluations and this analysis of requests for change in regulation, what the standard for that analysis is, and how the legislator receives that information are all very important as we go forward. And I look forward to working with my colleagues and everyone out there in the public who has an interest in this area of seeing what we can do over time to do a better, improve our work in the licensing area, because one thing we did learn today, it's an important growing area in terms of its role in our economy, and certainly we should seek to further understand it and our regulatory and legislative roles in that. So I thank the three speakers this morning for your time, and those of you in the audience, and for my fellow members of the committee, thank you, and we are adjourned.